loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam has declared a state of emergency in Charlottesville in advance of the one-year anniversary of the violent Unite the Right rally. Last year, a right-wing extremist ran over and killed 32-year-old Heather Heyer. This year, authorities are preparing for the worst. Next, President Trump's new Space Force will be the first new military branch since the creation of the Air Force 70 years ago, if Congress approves it and it can get off the ground. But what exactly is a Space Force, and do we really need one? Then, Fusion GPS founder Glenn Simpson met secretly with one of Barack Obama's senior-most Justice Department officials, Bruce Orr, immediately after the 2016 election, according to Orr's handwritten notes that were released yesterday. In that meeting, Simpson told Orr that Trump attorney Michael Cohen was the secret middleman between the campaign and the Russian government. Simpson admitted in sworn testimony last year to the House Intelligence Committee that he had contact with Orr after Trump's election victory, but Orr's notes provide the first detailed public account of what the two men actually discussed. We'll get into the details. And then the National Security Archive, a private academic organization at George Washington University that is the repository for declassified government documents, announced today that its Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the CIA for documents related to the agency's director, Gina Haspel's, involvement in the torture program, was successful. The archives already have released those documents, and they are damning in the information they provide on Haspel and torture. And finally, Code Pink is one of the most active and influential peace organizations in America, tackling issues from Gaza to immigration to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the leading members of that group is our friend and frequent guest, Anne Wright. Earlier this week, Anne found herself at the U.S.-Mexico border, where she's been working to improve the plight of so many immigrants to this country. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Virginia Governor Ralph Northam has declared a state of emergency in Charlottesville in advance of the one-year anniversary of the violent Unite the Right rally. Last year, a right-wing extremist ran over and killed 32-year-old Heather Heyer. This year, authorities are preparing for the worst. We're joined from Washington by Kay Pritzker. He's a D.C.-based activist who is one of the organizers of the counter-protest against the Unite the Right 2 rally in Washington, D.C. Kay, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Kay, this rally here in Washington this weekend is a very big deal. Tell us a little bit about what's going to happen, where it's going to happen, and something about the planning.
Yeah, so obviously everyone's aware of the Charlottesville terror attack, essentially, that happened last year around this time in Charlottesville. And those same white supremacists, Nazis, neo-Confederates that organized that quote-unquote Unite the Right rally are having a second rally, essentially a celebration of the mayhem and destruction they caused last year. And that's happened. They're rallying in front of the White House. So our counter demo will be in front of the White House as well in Lafayette Park. And we will be standing against their racism, asking them to, you know, leave D.C. And yeah, the planning has been going well. We're having a coalition of D.C.-based groups as well as groups from other states supporting this counter demo. We're going to have a stage, speakers, all of that. It should be a good counter demonstration.
Yeah. You know, Donald Trump said after August 12th last year, at first he it took a long time for him to speak.
Yes,
and then he finally
days.
Spoke and he read from somebody had written something that was whatever. But then he got a chance to speak off the cuff and he was like, there are some very fine people on both sides, meaning amongst the Nazis and Klan, who carried out what you, I think, adequately described as a terrorist action. This guy, one of their ranks, drove a car at a high speed right into the anti-Nazi protesters, killing Heather Heyer, a terrible 32-year-old woman, but injuring so many other people. And then the president of the United States says, oh, yeah, there's some very fine people amongst them. Really something, right?
Yeah, it's there's been this whole game on the far right, this ultra right group that where they use these euphemisms. You know, Trump obviously said there are fine people, and he sort of dodged around the fact that they literally murdered someone. These right wing groups are calling this a white civil rights rally. So there's this large attempt on the right wing to really mask what this is. And I think Eugene Puryear actually talked about this on his show, that Jason Kessler and some of the organizers are calling for people to not bring swastikas. So I think, you know, a lot of the people on the right have an understanding of the political character, the political nature of this rally, but they know it's uncouth. They know this is unpopular, especially in D.C., among the masses of people in D.C. So they're using these weird euphemisms like, you know, white civil rights or fine people on both sides, trying to equate the two sides when there is no equation between these two sides. One side is, you know, these terrorists, these white supremacists, and the other side is the masses of people that want to live in peace.
Okay, David Duke is one of the speakers. David Duke mm-hmm. was the formerly Grand Wizard of the KKK, and I think you're right. They're just rebranding themselves because the old brand doesn't work. But David Duke in 1991, 92 was running for governor of Louisiana, John.
And won the Republican nomination.
He won the Republican nomination, and he almost won. I mean, he came up short at the end. But, you know, I think that's important to remind people of, because some people, including so-called liberals and so-called progressives, say, oh, ignore the Nazis, ignore the Klan. You're just playing into their hands. But Kay is right. Organizations like the Answer Coalition and others are rallying together because you can't ignore the Nazis and the Klan. It's not as it could be look like a fringe group now, but you know, very quickly that can change.
It can. I want to add something too, and this gives you an indication of how politics have changed in the United States over the last generation or so. In the 1980s, David Duke ran for the United States Senate. He ran against an incumbent senator in the Republican primary, and he came within a whisker of winning. The reason that he didn't win was because Ronald Reagan came out and condemned him and said that the man is a racist. He has no business being in the Republican Party. And he urged people not to vote. You know what? Let me correct myself. He won the Republican nomination, was running against a Democrat, John Breaux. And Reagan endorsed the Democrat so that he could stop this former Grand Wizard of the KKK from being elected to the United States Senate. Can you imagine Donald Trump today urging people to vote for a Democrat in order to stop one of these Klansmen or alt-right extremists that he only a year ago described as some very fine people?
No, I can't. Obviously, Trump has been very vocal in his support of, you know, not only conservatives and Republicans, but his type of Republicans and conservatives. He, you know, often picks fights with other members of the Republican Party. And yeah, I mean, these far right groups that are even farther right of Trump himself are a symptom of Trump and Trump's America. I think, you know, it's not so much a lot of people tend to focus on the president himself, which is obviously important. He is a racist. But I think what's even more important is that he's emboldened all of these far right groups, which, you know, he calls the silent majority. And I think what he's referring to is the fact that there is a large portion of America that still silently believed a lot of these racist and awful things and now feel like the president is giving them a rubber stamp, which he essentially did when he called, you know, those people, those white supremacists, fine people. He's basically endorsing it. So no, I could never see Donald Trump, you know, endorsing a Democrat over one of these races.
We're speaking from Washington with Kay Pritzker. He's a D.C.-based activist who is one of the organizers of the counter-protest against the Unite the Right 2 rally here in Washington. Kay, tell us how people can get involved. We're kind of bumping up against the event, but I imagine that it's not too late to get involved. How would people do that?
No, it's definitely not too late to get involved. I think the first thing you should do is sign up for Answer Coalition's mailing list. Just go Google Answer Coalition and you can find you know, a slot to put your email in, and you'll get updates that Answer Coalition is sending out about the rally. Obviously, turnout on August 12th, so that our demo will be in Lafayette Park at 1 p.m. And you can show up even a little earlier if you want to help set up. And then going forward, like, this is also not an isolated event. This is part of a larger system of white supremacy and racism in America. So the struggle never, you know, it doesn't end with this one demo. So, you know, try to stay involved with Answer Coalition or local groups in D.C. And, you know, come out, talk to people, meet people. There are a lot of really strong and welcoming, kind activists that you'll meet if you turn out to this event, and they can, you know, help you get more involved in the future.
One of the things that I think is important And I think Kay put it exactly right, where he said, you know, in the past, racists and white supremacists had to sort of speak in code language,
yes,
dog whistles, so to speak. But under Trump, people feel emboldened. So here you have the ultra-right, the fascists, the Klan, the Nazis, David Duke coming together. Well, who are their enemies? Their enemies are black people. Their enemies are Jewish people. Their enemies are Muslims. Their enemies are immigrants. Their enemies are people who believe in women's rights. Their enemies are the LGBTQ community. When you have all of these people who would be directly and are directly impacted, that's a message like, why don't we all come together instead of every group, every segment, every constituency marching separately for itself, march together. And I think that's what we will also see on Sunday, is kind of the Rainbow Coalition, so to speak, meaning all of these different sectors of society who actually do have something really in common. And, you know, we were quoting the other day, John, from Niemöller, you know, yes, about the rise of Nazism. Germany was a progressive country. It was liberal, progressive
people don't
country.
Know that.
And Niemöller's quote was, when they came for the communists, I wasn't a communist, so I didn't do anything. When they came for the Jews, I wasn't a Jew, so I didn't do anything, et cetera, et cetera. Making the point that people actually have to take this seriously, that they have to unite. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been a lot of strange calls to not engage with this rally or not turn out, because it apparently, you know, elevates or like promotes the Nazis' message, which isn't true. You know, I've spoken to people in D.C. When I was flyering, and there's an obvious desire in the community to get these people out of D.C.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the voice of Kay Pritzker. He joined us from Washington. Kay is a D.C.-based activist who is one of the organizers of the counter-protest against the Unite the Right 2 rally in Washington, D.C. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump's new Space Force will be the first new military branch since the creation of the Air Force 70 years ago, if Congress approves it and it can get off the ground. But what exactly is a Space Force, and do we really need one? We're joined from Maine by Bruce Gagnon. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. Bruce, it's been a long time. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Bruce, let's start with the most obvious question. What is this Space Force and why do we need it?
Well, we don't need it, that's for sure, unless we want to destabilize space the way we've destabilized the planet with our endless wars, our killing, our massive wasteful expenditures on the military, which have necessitated incredible cutbacks in human needs programs and environmental cleanup programs. So certainly we don't need the Space Force. But beyond that, the truth is, for a long time, the United States has had a U.S. Space Command. In fact, back in 1997, headquartered at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs, Colorado, on their doorway, above the door, it reads Master of Space. That's their logo. The U.S. Space Command put out a planning document in 97 saying that the U.S. would control space, dominate space, and deny other countries from having access to space, that we would be the master of space. So this has been around a long time, but Trump is now taking it to the next level. And I think what's really driving it is that the aerospace industry has long said that full-blown Star Wars would be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. And they recognize that they can make all kinds of money if they can really concretize a new service-level space force and sink huge money into it. And I think that's really what's driving it.
Yeah, you know, this is really not new. If you look through news archives, Ronald Reagan talked about this. Donald Rumsfeld talked about it in 2001. This has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, Star Wars, what Reagan introduced, I mean, that was considered by then the real impetus for the arms race of the 1980s. Because, of course, if the high ground becomes outer space in a military battle and one side has superiority at the high ground, That means all bets are off. All earlier arms agreements that have equilibrium and stability are off. You know, Bruce Gagnon, I want to actually turn for a quick second. You know, Putin and Trump met at Helsinki. In the American media, that meeting was treated as just a terrible thing because the two leaders talked and Trump was, quote, demonstrating weakness because he met with Putin instead of, I guess, just continuing to do all things hostile with extreme hostility towards Russia. But the Politico was able to get hold of the document that the Russians had introduced at the Helsinki summit. And the Russian document, this is from from Politico, I want to read it. The Russian document also raised the prospect of a new space treaty that bars both nations from placing weapons in orbit, urging the two countries, quote, to discuss the non-placement of weapons in space, close quote. That's from the Russian document. The U.S. and Russia are both party to the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, but that only prohibits placing weapons of mass destruction in space, nuclear weapons. Both nations, along with China, are believed to be working on anti-satellite weapons and other offensive weapons, other offensive means to attack space assets. So here the Russians came to Trump quietly and said, let's talk about expanding or updating the 1967 treaty, Outer Space Treaty. Back in 1967, liberal people, progressive people, people who cared about peace would have said, that's fundamentally important not to militarize outer space. But here, you know, that's considered part of like going along with Russia, I guess.
Well, this idea, actually, it's both Russia and China have annually introduced at the United Nations General Assembly a treaty called PAROS, P-A-R-O-S, Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space, where, as you say, the Outer Space Treaty from 67 is limited in definition. It only covered weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons. But now they're talking about introducing weapons of selective destruction, which fall outside of that treaty. So Russia and China are saying, let's update this treaty. Let's create a new treaty. And in the last 25 years, Republicans, Democrats together have virtually destroyed any effort by Russia and China to bring this treaty to the United Nations. Every year, the United States and Israel blocked this treaty from going forward at the United Nations Conference on Disarmament. So it's really clearly being driven by the industry, because the U.S. response has always been the same. Hey, there's no problem. There's no need to negotiate a ban on weapons in space. There are no weapons in space. So there's no issue here. And it was always because they wanted an open door that would not prevent them from making money off driving the arms race and trying to maintain superiority and dominance.
Tell us what such a program would entail, Bruce. You know, it's easy to picture an Air Force because they have fighter jets and bombers and stealth and things like that. Are we talking about an entire generation of space-based weapons, space-based rockets? Are we talking about platforms, permanent platforms in space where people would actually be living on them? Well, how does this work?
I think the imagination could run wild with that question. I think we have to go back and have some understanding about where this all came from. And it really came from the program called Operation Paperclip at the end of World War II, when Wernher von Braun, he was Hitler's Nazi rocket scientist that built the V-1 and V-2 rockets. He and 100 copies of the V-2 rocket and about 100 of his top scientists and engineers were brought to the United States in secret to create the U.S. space program. And following that, they began to get themselves put into various positions of power. For example, Major General Walter Dornberger, who was Hitler's liaison, top liaison officer between Hitler himself and von Braun, he came to the U.S., went to work for Bell Aerospace. And in the 1950s, Major General Walter Dornberger, a top Nazi, testified before the Congress of the United States saying, gentlemen, I didn't come to this country to lose the Third World War. We lost two already. And he gave his vision of orbiting battle stations, satellites armed with weapons that could destroy other countries' satellites, but also hit targets on the earth below. And these are the very technologies that today would be part of this new Space Force. These are the very technologies that today are being worked on by the military-industrial complex. So I've always said it was a Nazi prophecy that has now come to fruition in this country. And I've always asked this question, that when you seed the military-industrial complex of America with 1,500 of the top Nazi operatives from intelligence, from all kinds of different programs, Hitler's military programs, where they were seeded into the U.S., was there also an ideological contamination that came along with that? And I believe it can clearly be said that there is.
Yeah, I think General Dornberger, who became vice president of Bell Labs, the Nazi general, and who was involved with Wernher von Braun in the space program, I think he was asked, well, was it hard for you to come over to the United States and join the enemy, so to speak? And he said, oh, no, we always really had the same enemy. It was the Soviet Union, which, of course, is true. I mean, there was a war between the United States and Germany, and the United States was for a while an ally of the Soviet Union against Nazi Germany. But as soon as World War II ended and as soon as the German expansionist plan was defeated, the U.S. incorporated so many of the Nazis and brought them into the United States, again, as part of a secret plan, a secret operation. And they were also used in large measure to construct the West German government after 1945, right?
That's right. And General Galen, who was one of the leaders of the Nazi intelligence program, especially in Eastern Europe for Hitler. After the war, he was brought to the U.S. under Operation Paperclip. And when the new West German government was created, after the war with this divided East and West Germany, the U.S. had Galen installed as the new director of intelligence for West Germany. So here you had, Germany had been defeated, and now you took one of the top intelligence Nazis and put him in charge of West German intelligence. So since the end of World War II, the United States has had a very close working relationship with the Nazis. And there's so much evidence of this, so much history, most of it little known.
Bruce, let me just ask you real quick in the last minute. This, maybe Mike Pence was the one who made this announcement. The U.S. is going forward with a new command, the Space Command. This is, I guess, the Trump administration's response or answer to that which the Russians, Putin, proposed in Helsinki, where they said, let's not do this. This is the answer, no?
That's right. And now the public has to respond. Fortunately, the Global Network annually has a week of protests in October called Keep Space for Peace Week. And this year, our theme is No Space Force. I urge people to go to our website, spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org, and take a look at our poster and consider helping organize some kind of local protest or educational event during the week of Keep Space for Peace Week, October 6th through 13th. Let us know that you're doing it. We'll be keeping track of events all over the world. And this is one way that we can immediately respond and have people around the planet say, we don't want to move the arms race into space. This is insane.
It's crazy, but it's happening.
It is. It's crazy, but it's happening. We'll have to leave it there. We were joined from Maine by Bruce Gagnon. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, and he's also a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Fusion GPS founder Glenn Simpson met secretly with one of Barack Obama's senior-most Justice Department officials, Bruce Orr, immediately after the 2016 election, according to Orr's handwritten notes that were released yesterday. In that meeting, Simpson told Orr that Trump attorney Michael Cohen was the secret middleman between the campaign and the Russian government. Simpson admitted in sworn testimony last year to the House Intelligence Committee that he had contact with Orr after Trump's election victory, but Orr's notes provide the first detailed public account of what the two men actually discussed. To best understand this, I want to quote from an article posted on thehill.com on August 9th, authored by investigative journalist John Solomon. It says, "Congressional investigators are now scouring them for evidence that Simpson and Steele had influence over the Russia probe, even after Steele was dismissed as an FBI informant in November 2016. Investigators want to know if any players in the Russia probe gave Congress false testimony. One notation that stands out is Simpson's account that he asked Steele to talk with Mother Jones reporter David Korn about their muckraking on Trump and Russia in the final days of the election. At the time, Steele still worked as an FBI source. Korn's October 31, 2016 story was one of the most definitive to allege possible ties between the Trump campaign and Moscow, creating an important talking point for Democrats in the final days of the campaign. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, LeftEyeBlog. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, this is complicated. It's involved. Are we looking at someone who went to the committees because he's a patriotic American and wanted to set the record straight? Or are we looking at someone who went to the Justice Department and later to the committees because of political influence?
And Steve, before you answer that, you know, Glenn Simpson, Fusion GPS CEO, hired Christopher Steele on behalf of the Democratic National Committee. And his explanation of why he went to the FBI with his allegations that the Trump administration was in some way colluding with the Russian government, he said he did it out of a civic duty. Steele working as an FBI source at that time and at the end of October and going to the media, it would indicate that it's politics. It would seem to me that this is politics rather than out of the civic duty of Glenn Simpson or Christopher Steele having to talk to the FBI. In other words, politics. And there's more about this that indicates conflict of interest and pure politics. The Fusion GPS CEO and founder Glenn Simpson had told House investigators last year that he had only met Department of Justice official Bruce Orr after the 2016 election. But Orr's records show that he was, in fact, in contact with Simpson as early as August 2016. That was still during the election campaign. And of course, as has come out in the past, Orr, the deputy attorney general's wife, actually worked for Fusion GPS, led by Glenn Simpson, and she worked on the Steele dossier. I mean, we're talking about a massive conflict of interest.
Indeed. And I think there's two very strong clues in Orr's notes that we can read about. The first was Orr summarizing what Simpson was saying about what he was doing. And he says it was Glenn's Hail Mary attempt. In other words, this is by that, we're talking about him talking to David Korn, the Mother Jones reporter, just before the election, which resulted in an article before the election. So by saying it was Glenn's Hail Mary attempt, that means he was desperate to do something to get Trump not elected, which many of us were desperate. But this indicates that Glenn Simpson, among others, was not motivated by, you know, some noble goal of preventing crime, but was actually all about politics, trying to, you know, do something to prevent Trump from being elected. The other clue, which I think is also critical, is Simpson talked about, he testified before Congress, and he talked about how people report crimes after all. But what he said at the time was, I'll read this verbatim, this is a quote from Glenn Simpson, "At the time we, you know, that Chris decided to take this to the FBI, I wasn't convinced of the facts of anything in terms of, I wasn't convinced that there was a specific crime that occurred." That's actually misleading. Not only wasn't he convinced that there was a specific crime that was occurred, he surely couldn't have been convinced that any of this was true at all. So he didn't even know, and there still was no proof of the vast majority of the things that are in the Steele dossier. So this is kind of like, I was thinking about this before, this is kind of like me losing my wallet and then calling the police and saying, you know, my wallet has been stolen. you can't report a crime if you don't even know a crime has been committed. So the idea that he was reporting a crime is just bogus.
And the thing reeks of conflict of interest, maybe perhaps the purest form of conflict of interest, because here you have the Democratic administration, the Obama administration, or as the Deputy Attorney General, meeting with Glenn Simpson, who's been hired by the Clinton campaign, a former Obama official in the State Department, to dig up opposition research against another candidate, Donald Trump. They rely on a British foreign intelligence agent. They're paying him. He comes up with uncorroborated evidence of all with all of these salacious details. But what's the source for those salacious uncorroborated evidence? It's undoubtedly Russians, because they're talking about what Trump did in Russia. So they're paying former Russian intelligence agents to tell them something. Then we have Simpson and Steele pretending that they went to the FBI out of civic duty, when in fact they were part of an operation to defeat Donald Trump. And again, John, you're an opponent of Donald Trump during the election.
Sure.
I was an opponent of Donald Trump during the election. Steve Pat was an opponent of Donald Trump during the election. And since I know I've been organizing against a lot of Donald Trump's terrible policies. That's not the point here. It's not about...
Not at all.
It's really about this pure conflict of interest and how the country's been taken down the road of the Russia collusion story, which is clearly now, I think it's quite evident from these notes, it's based on a political, not a legal operation from the get-go.
And, you know, there were indications of that from the get-go, but still, people ignored those indications, and it's as though the mainstream media and even half of the elected officials on Capitol Hill really wanted to find some kind of collusion. Even though over the long run, of course, it's very bad for the country, they wanted to find collusion and actively looked for it and then even sought it out where none existed.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, we're in this situation and there still is no evidence of collusion.
And The Hill, the newspaper and media outlet here in Washington, I want to read a little bit more from their article about this. And again, this is Orr, Obama's deputy attorney general. Much of the other, this is a quote from the Hill, much of the other information attributed to Simpson that December day when he met with Orr, according to Orr's notes, involve admittedly uncorroborated allegations such as claims that a computer server in a Russian-owned bank was secretly transmitting messages to the Trump campaign, or that the NRA was secretly taking money from a Russian official. Many of the claims eventually made their way into news reports. Yes, mm-hmm. It was for the media. Orr made clear he took possession of some evidence from Simpson, the CEO of Fusion GPS, hired by Clinton to do the opposition research, writing, quote, Glenn gave me a memory stick. Now, Orr knows it's uncorroborated evidence, but he's meeting secretly with Glenn Simpson, giving him a memory stick. And of course, as part of the Justice Department, which was then pursuing the Russia probe. I mean, wow, the thing stinks, actually, Steve Pat.
Yeah, by the way, that Russian-owned bank secretly transmitting messages to the Trump campaign, that was debunked in a few days after that news hit the press. The business about the NRA taking money, we don't know about the NRA finances even today. But the business about the bank and the secret contacts, that's nonsense. It was debunked. It's not uncorroborated. It's proven false.
Yeah. And again, going back to the Hill article, a couple of the experts flagged that most of what Simpson allegedly told Orr was not even from Moscow. I'm reading from the
right.
Hill again, where the alleged plot was supposed to be based, but from a reported Russian in the United States who later seemed to disappear. That's interesting, according to Orr's notes. I mean, wow. I mean, just think, I mean, again, it's very hard for the audience to wade through all of these details, but this is a pretty stunning revelation, it would seem to me, Steve Pat.
Yeah. You know, one thing I think about is the whole big picture. For example, in these notes, he talks about a theory that Glenn Simpson offered to Orr about how Paul Manafort, Carter Page, and Michael Cohen, all three of them, had a secret channel with Moscow to hijack the election. So the question is, what did they do? I mean, if you believe everything about the Russia meddling story. Russia ran, the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, ran some Facebook ads which weren't even placed in battleground states. So,
and 56% of them came after the election.
Right. Also, they some Russian hackers stole some emails from Hillary Clinton, gave them to WikiLeaks, who's, again, according to this theory, if you believe everything, really a secret Russian intelligence outlet, and then they released them. So what role did Paul Manafort, Carter Page, and Michael Cohen have? What did they have to do with any of this? Nothing. I mean, all of these things that we're talking about, again, if you believe all of them, were done by Russia, not by Paul Manafort, Carter Page, and Michael Cohen. So it's, the whole theory is just kind of preposterous on its face.
As we go out, I want to read the final paragraph, John, from the article in The Hill. And the article is authored by John Solomon. He's an award-winning investigative journalist. Here's what it says, last paragraph. Whatever their assessment, Congress has a wide new mandate to investigate the Simpson or Steele contacts with renewed vigor and lots of questions that did not exist just a few short weeks ago. What was on that memory stick that Simpson gave Orr? What did Orr do with the information? Did the FBI rely on it for future court actions? Did the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court that approved surveillance warrants know Orr was getting information from the Simpson-Steele operation after Steele had been dismissed, meaning dismissed from the FBI because he went to the media? A new chapter is opening, I believe.
I have to agree. I think this is one of the most explosive issues, the most explosive pieces of information that we have seen in this scandal.
Yeah.
I think it's important. We're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Patt. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. And Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, with I being the letter I. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The National Security Archive, a private academic organization based at George Washington University that is the repository for declassified government documents, announced today that its Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the CIA for documents related to CIA Director Gina Haspel's involvement in the torture program was successful. The archive already has released these documents, and they are damning in the information they provide on Haspel and torture. We're joined from Washington by Sue Udry. She is a peace and social justice activist and executive director of Defending Rights and Dissent. Sue, welcome back.
Thanks a lot. It's good to see you guys, John, Brian.
Sue, a lot of these documents are the original documents on which the Senate torture report was based. Now, some of the names, all of the names, are still redacted, but it's very easy to figure out where the documents are referencing Gina Haspel and the two contract psychologists, Mitchell and Jessen. Gina Haspel was the chief of the secret site in, well, I probably shouldn't say where it is, even though everybody in the world knows where it was. It's officially not been declassified, so I'm going to save myself another prison sentence there. Anyway, we know that Gina Haspel was the director of that secret site from at least the end of October. She also personally oversaw the torture of Abdurrahim Eneshiri, who's accused of being the mastermind of the USS Cole bombing. Tell us a little bit about these documents, about what's new in these documents, and your impression on the release.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack with these documents. There's both the content in the cables and how horrifying and explicit it is that they describe the torture of al-Nashiri and it's who is accused. Right? He is accused of a horrible crime.
Accused. He's never been charged or tried.
Exactly. So that's the first thing, as people say, oh, he deserved it. he's not been proven guilty. And the other thing is, you know, okay, maybe he's a very bad man, but it doesn't mean that we have to descend to this level of inhumanity to punish our accused opponents. So the content of the cables is, you know, it's visceral when you read it. You experience emotions of just horror that human beings could on purpose and calculatedly treat another human being the way that al-Nashiri was treated. So there's the content of the cables, but then there's also the process by which these cables were not revealed to the public before Gina Haspel's confirmation hearing. And that's, you know, in my mind, maybe as great a crime or as great a crime against democracy, because first of all, we know Gina Haspel was the deputy director of the CIA. I mean, she was the acting director of the CIA before her confirmation hearing. So she's the person who was controlling the flow of information out of the CIA to the public. So she was able to withhold these very damning cables from the public and from members of Congress. And then there's also the fact that the National Security Archives were suing for these documents as her hearing was rapidly approaching, and they were arguing that, you know, in the public interest, these documents should be released right now before her hearing. But the CIA dragged their feet on that, so the cables are just coming out right now.
I want to read one short paragraph that the National Security Archive includes in its press release, because I think this really exemplifies what we're talking about here. It says, the biggest mystery in the released cables is whether Gina Haspel wrote cable number 11359 from December 1st, 2002, which uses remarkably vivid language to describe the torture sessions. Quote, the interrogators strode cat-like into the well-lit confines of the cell at 0902 hours. Redacted deftly removed the subject's black hood with a swipe, paused, and in a deep, measured voice said that subject, having calmed down after his staged run-in with his hulking, heavily muscled guards the previous day, should reveal what subject had done to vex his guards to the point of rage, unquote. I know Mitchell and Jessen. They don't write like that. I know Gina Haspel. She does write like that. And so that tells me that Gina wasn't just the administrative head of the secret site. Gina was personally involved in the day-to-day torture of these prisoners. She was there, she witnessed it, and then she wrote about it.
They came into the cell with cat-like, what?
Yes, cat. They strode cat-like into the well-lit confines of the cell.
That sounds like somebody who's pretty excited. I mean, that's
You can
vivid.
Say that again.
I mean, these are, and you know, John and Sue, these facts, this story is so important. And when you had the U.S. Senate start to prepare the report on torture about the CIA's criminal conduct, and it's criminal.
Sure,
it's not legal.
Sure, it is.
You can,
on multiple levels.
You can write whatever legal memos you want. It's against international law and it's against U.S. law. Torture is illegal. Then you had the CIA under John Brennan actually hacking the U.S. Senate, which is the oversight committees for the CIA, and carrying out a covert operation against the Senate committee to try to stop that report from coming out.
That's right.
That's John Brennan, everybody.
And listen to the carryover, too. It says in this National Security Archive press release that all of the dates in these cables were redacted. But I just read to you a paragraph which says that the cable was from December 1st, 2002. Now, the CIA says that those dates are classified, but they didn't realize that they've already declassified the dates in the 2005 Inspector General's report. So all they needed to do, all the analysts at the National Security Archive needed to do, was to compare the Inspector General's report with these new cables and just match the cable with the date. And that's how the CIA operates. As little information as possible. That's what they want out there. If they can get away with putting nothing out there, that's their preference.
For sure. Well, there's a couple of things from what you both just said. First of all, to save John another prison sentence, I'll out that the secret site was in Thailand, just in case people don't know. And the other thing that I just wanted to point out about that, the last cable, the one that was written where the interrogator strode cat-like into the well-lit confines of the cell, that sounds to me like somebody who romanticizes this.
Yes.
It's not just that they're enthusiastic, but they romanticize it. And that's just so creepy that this woman who romanticizes torture and romanticizes inhumanity toward another human being is now the director of the CIA. And the CIA has so much latitude to not only operate in the shadows, but to stay in the shadows. I mean, they have huge latitude to break laws and to just be pure evil without telling us. And with a president like Trump, and with a director like Gina Haspel, that's just really frightening.
Sue, a CIA psychiatrist once told me during the course of a conversation that the CIA actively seeks to hire people who have sociopathic tendencies. They try not to hire sociopaths because sociopaths have no conscience and they can easily pass a polygraph. People who have sociopathic tendencies do have a conscience, but are happy and willing to work in legal and moral and ethical gray areas. The problem is, just by their nature, the nature of their psychology, sociopaths will slip through the process. Now, we also know from numerous psychological studies, not having anything to do with the CIA, that in any large organization like a corporation, sociopaths will rise to the top because they're happy to step on the backs of other people to get ahead. Well, the CIA is a big bureaucracy like any corporation. And if you're already looking for people with sociopathic tendencies, you're going to get sociopaths who will rise to the top. That sentence about how the interrogator strode cat-like into the well-lit confines of the cell, a sociopath wrote that sentence. And to me, that makes it very, very clear what we're dealing with here.
Yeah. And so then the question becomes, what do we do about it now?
That's right. That's right. And what do we do about it now?
Yeah. Yeah. Why did I bring that up? Because I don't know what we do about it right now. I think it means that advocacy groups and investigative journalists need to really be keeping their eye focused on the CIA as much as possible. I think we need to hold the feet of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees. We need to hold their feet to the fire to make sure that they're really doing oversight. We need to make sure that they are as, you know, half as concerned as we are about this woman who is directing this clandestine agency. I think we need to develop what sort of advocacy strategy we want to pursue. But right now, we need to be incredibly vigilant about what the CIA is up to.
I'll just throw in my own two cents on this. We need to look at this in a nonpartisan way because Brennan is the opposition to Trump now, and he's on CNN or wherever he is. Mm-hmm. Some people are saying, oh, John Brennan is my guy because I'm against Trump. And of course, we're against Trump too. But and vice versa, you can say the same on the other side. And when you get to issues, Sue, like torture, like basic issues of law or of rights, to have this filter through, am I a Democrat, am I a Republican, that's just wrong. 20 seconds left.
Well, yeah, totally agree with you, and that's a whole nother show, which I know you guys have been talking about. Can I add just one piece of good news is that the American Psychological Association on Wednesday did vote to continue to prevent military psychologists from working at Guantanamo and being engaged in torture.
Thank you very much. I was one of the authors of those new rules.
Awesome.
Unfortunately, we're out of time because I'd like to talk a lot more about that. We were joined from Washington by Sue Udry. She is a peace and social justice activist and executive director of Defending Rights and Dissent. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Code Pink is one of the most active and influential peace organizations in America, tackling issues from Gaza to immigration to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the leading members of that group is our friend and frequent guest, Anne Wright. Earlier this week, Anne found herself at the U.S.-Mexico border, where she's been working to improve the plight of so many immigrants to this country. Anne joins us from Houston. She's a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became an anti-war activist. Anne, it's always good to have you.
Thank you, John and Brian. Great to be with you.
Anne, tell us what you're doing at the border down there in Texas.
Well, I just came back from being at McAllen, Texas, and then Brownsville, Texas. And I was down there with a group called Grannies Respond, grandmothers and grandfathers from all over the country that took caravans and stopped in communities along the way to talk about what's happening to families on the border that are trying to immigrate to the United States as refugees. And it was really quite remarkable to be with that group and have the local organizers in both Brownsville and McAllen tell us what they, as local, you know, as citizens, are doing to help all of these people, some of whom are coming out of detention facilities, having been in detention for months at a time, and then others that are across the border on the Mexican side and are waiting for ICE to allow them to come across the border and then go immediately into the detention facilities and await for a determination of whether they are then going to be paroled to go to their sponsors throughout the United States and go to court for a determination of what their status is, or whether they are going to get deported back to Mexico.
And we hear so much in the press about how people, average people in Greece, on the Greek islands, help the migrants who find their way to Greece from Turkey or across the Mediterranean from North Africa. We really don't hear very much in our own media about what Americans on the border are doing to help migrants who are coming across that border from Mexico. What are you learning?
Well, we learned a lot about the great generosity of Americans who are working very hard to greet people as they come out of the detention facilities and help them get bus tickets onto their sponsors that are providing shelter for them if it takes a while to get the bus tickets, to provide backpacks full of sundry supplies so that they have something immediately coming out of these detention facilities. We went to the McAllen Greyhound bus station and saw how one man, Luis, who's been there every day, every night for 6 years, to greet people who are being dumped off the buses from ICE, from whatever detention facility it is, and is there to be a friend, to be there to talk with them, to answer questions, to tell them actually where they are, because many of them are coming from detention facilities all over South Texas and are just dropped off unceremoniously at a place two blocks from the bus station and told, just go straight ahead two blocks and there'll be a bus station. Catholic Charities has a very, very active program in McAllen and is doing great work, as are other organizations there that are helping folks as they come out of the facilities. And then on the Mexican side of the border, the Mexican Red Cross is helping people that are stacked up on the border, actually sitting on bridges waiting for ICE to come and talk to them and make a determination if they're going to be allowed to come across and go directly into these detention facilities.
Wow.
The local folks in Mexico bring food to the bridges so that people have something to eat. They bring water. They help in any way that they can. And they also are very vigilant because a lot of the coyotes that have swiped thousands of dollars from people to bring them up, sometimes even from the bridge, the coyotes then kidnap people off the bridge and take them for further ransom.
Oh, it's really
quite a remarkable scene.
Oh, that's absolutely awful. I wanted to ask you, too, here in the Northern Virginia area, at least in my neighborhood, people have put signs out in the fronts of their yards saying that anyone who is undocumented is welcome here in this home. And it's a nice gesture. It's a nice symbol. But I wonder if there are people who are housing undocumented migrants just to keep them safe from organizations like ICE and the Customs and Border Protection. Is that happening down there?
I think undoubtedly there are people that do have homes available, and churches too, as the sanctuary. But there are also other people that are opening their homes or helping shelters such as the Catholic Charities provide a place for a day or two for people who have already been in detention, some of them months at a time, others sometimes only a few days. And the volunteers in McAllen were saying, we have no idea what the criteria is when some families are staying months in these detention facilities, and then other people are just staying a couple of days. Of course, we are not really privy to the criteria that ICE is using and how it makes its determination on who stays for long periods of time and who is given the opportunity to, as an adult, put on an ankle bracelet. All the adults, as they are released from these detention facilities, have ankle bracelets on, so their whereabouts is tracked. And then they go to wherever their sponsor is, and the sponsor has to send money to the Greyhound bus station at whatever location they are dropped off, whether it's McAllen or Brownsville or any other place along the border. And then the person gets the ticket and then hops on the bus, and off they go to hopefully be met by their sponsor and, you know, wherever it is.
One of the big stories here, I'm so glad we're talking to Ann about the just terrible treatment of individuals and individual families, and the good-heartedness and the commitment of people in the United States to do what the government should be doing but isn't doing. The government's doing just the opposite. It precedes Trump. I mean, it's not just Trump, but it's especially bad under Trump, because Trump is not only demonizing individuals and separating families as a matter of policy, because he wants to say to other families, don't you dare come if you want to, you know, stay with your kids. He's also trying to undo the existing immigration system altogether. And one of the big things, Ann, right, is that he's been making such a big deal against chain migration, whereby people come, they become citizens or become legal residents, and then they bring their parents or their family or their children. And I'm just looking because yesterday, John, First Lady Melania Trump's parents became U.S. citizens.
That's right. They absolutely did.
In a naturalization ceremony in New York, they were former residents of Yugoslavia, the Slovenian Republic of Yugoslavia. We don't know. I don't know exactly how they got there. As of 2007, though, they said in their visa application, their residence card, that they were living at Mar-a-Lago, Florida. I don't know.
Pretty nice.
And right, it is chain migration. Nothing wrong with it. Melania Trump became a U.S. citizen. She helped bring her family. That's okay, it seems like, if you're connected to the Trump family. But Trump, and especially I think this is designed to put out people of color and Latino and African people, he wants to end the system whereby people who have become naturalized citizens can actually help bring their family members. In other words, keep families separated that way too, as long as those families are people who aren't coming from Europe.
Well, indeed, it is one of the challenges of that whole system. There are various groups, from various countries, where the naturalization or bringing other members of the family over actually goes into decades. That there are so many people who want to bring family members over, that the process is a very long process, and there are so many people that it is interesting who gets the opportunity to get naturalized first. Because I know, particularly in the Filipino community, Mexican community, there are hundreds of thousands of people that are waiting in line for that type of naturalization.
Yeah, Trump said, quote, "We want to get rid of chain migration." But I don't think he was talking about Melania's parents.
Right. And the Republicans hate that term, chain migration. Or no, they love that term, chain migration. The Democrats don't like it because it was never called chain migration until
families.
Trump.
Yeah.
Right. It's called family reunification is what it's called.
Yeah. And if they could, they'd also like to get rid of the constitutional provision that if you're born in the United States, you have automatic citizenship.
Right. They don't like that.
Anyway, and right, we have 45 seconds left. How can people do what you're doing? How can people get involved?
Well, if you speak Spanish fluently, you can volunteer to come down to the border areas, but you do need to make prior arrangements with organizations such as Catholic Charities. If you want to help just from where you are, they need donations of money, and I can guarantee you the money is going in the right places to help people that are coming out of these detention facilities, and to help people that are over on the bridges in Mexico that are waiting to come across. It's not like people are getting lots of stuff or anything like that, but it's just the very basics to try to help keep people going until they reach their sponsor's home. So Catholic Charities is one of them, and if you look on that website and the Rio Grande Valley, you'll see a variety of places where you can help.
That was the voice of Anne Wright. She joined us from Houston. She's a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became an anti-war activist. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, at iHeartRadio, and now at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.